Hello, everybody. This is Sarah Longwell. I am here with my good friend, Benjamin Wittes, and welcome to A French Village podcast. Today, we are discussing season one, episodes 11 and 12, which is the finale. But the finale and the excitement contained in it holds nothing to the will-he, won't-he dynamic of the penultimate episode and the storyline surrounding Captain Carrot, which is what Ben Wittes has called himself on his Zoom photo here.
Yeah, so first of all, I just want to say, before we get into the meat of these episodes, that I know I said that Gustave was my favorite character, but Captain Carrot in episode 11 is really making a run for it, and Gustave better defend his position. Second thing I want to say is JVL's having taken to issuing threats to my health and safety on some of the other podcasts that you guys run is starting to get a little bit alarming, and you know, I don't know at what point veiled threats, like it would be terrible if something happened to Ben Wittes, requires law enforcement involvement. But I just want to say, Sarah, put a leash on that puppy.
Yeah, you know, here's the thing. JVL is harmless, but he's dark. And so he goes to these dark places, and he seems to be taking this very personally. Yeah. Good news is, likes the show, listens to the show.
It sounds like he kind of hates listens to the show. I just want to say to sort of message to JVL that I mean you no harm. I have never, not even once in the six episodes, of this show said the words, and I'm not going to say them now, but the B word in front of the friend word, I haven't said it once. And you know, I think a certain détente is appropriate here.
Yeah, I don't know if you're going to get it, man. He's in a state. But in any event, we have a season finale to discuss, which I'm excited about. So lots of action. But I think that we probably have to start with Gustave and Captain Carrot. When you say Captain Carrot is now your favorite, I don't understand that because I don't think the bunny doesn't do anything in these episodes.
Well, Captain Carrot, first of all, manages to avoid death, which is better than some of the other characters.
But not through his wiles or anything.
Well, I mean, some people get through Nazi occupation by luck. Some people get through by the negligence of the complicit. And some bunny rabbits get through because of sentiment of communists. And that is what happened here, that, you know, the whole 11th episode is organized around this caper that develops because poor little Gustave thinks his dad is going to feed Captain Carrot to the communist brass. And his father, who has shown exactly zero signs of being a softy about anything, turns out to incredulously say, you at the end of the episode, you thought I was going to kill your rabbit, which he caught in order to kill and feed to people. So I just want to say we have learned something through the admittedly inadvertent efforts of Captain Carrot. We have learned something substantial about Gustave's father, which is that he's a softy.
You know, that is not my read on it at all. So I actually had, so you're right in the way that this episode is organized around Captain Carrot. Lots of things come to light because of this, right? You know, the kids, in an attempt to save Captain Carrot from being eaten. They get the food coupons, the ration coupons from their hiding spot that they were playing with, which you may recall got Sarah fired because Janine Schwartz thought it was she who had taken them. And so the boys go and attempt to purchase a hedgehog pie with it so that the communists will have something else to eat and so they won't eat the rabbit. In doing so, they are caught. Because they don't understand the rations, they're giving them like clothing rations and things that are out of date.
And by the way, to the audience, if any of you has ever had hedgehog pie, we want to hear from you, because one of the great questions of episode 11 is, what does a hedgehog pie taste like?
Then the only hint they give you is what, it's better than a quail pie?
Yeah,
and I mean, it's superior to some other low-ranking fowl.
Yeah, exactly.
but here's let me just tell you my two gripes with the Captain Carrot storyline. So one is, I think that the show, which takes great pains to not put you like you are given sort of not, it's not uncritical, but they just present you with information and they do not emotionally manipulate you particularly often. But this, like, at no point have we been so concerned as the show so setting up you to feel fear for something. Like, lots of people die, get shot, get put in bad situations, but the show doesn't build around it and with the same, like, anticipation and fear that it does around whether or not this rabbit's going to get eaten. Which, to me, look, I'm not going to get into the whole pet thing. I get some blowback when I do this, where I'm just like,
don't worry, Captain Carrot's not a dog.
I'm just like not a huge pet person in general. But like, the point is that this rabbit is getting far more sort of treatment of concern from the show. Number one, that's my first thing. Let me just give you my second thing, which is on Marcel being a softy. The way that when they walk in at the end and he like turns Gustav to see like, there's your rabbit. You didn't really think I was going to eat your rabbit, means that this whole time he knew that that kid thought he might eat the rabbit. And like that he would wait until the bitter end when there's like a dead skinned rabbit over on the counter and then the alive pet rabbit still in the cage to unveil this, as opposed to, I think, you know, taking away a bunch of that anxiety early on, seems to me to be the better, the kinder thing.
This is the road to veganism. I mean, you know, if you imagine yourself as a six-year-old kid, you have a bunny rabbit that you love, you think your father is going to skin it and feed it to communists, and then you see a dead-skinned rabbit on the counter, you think it's your rabbit, and then your dad turns you around and shows you your live rabbit and says, ha, 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 I would never kill your rabbit. It's some other rabbit that I killed. And it's kind of a JVL kind of move. You know, you would never eat meat again. And I think that's what happened here. I actually think there's a more benign and less sentimental explanation for the focus on Captain Carrot, which is that it is a focus on Gustav, and it is a way of seeing this incredibly horrible world through the lens of a child's concerns. And, you know, the child is being asked to keep, you know, really important secrets by his father, secrets of life and death and imprisonment for people. It's the child's indiscretion, such as it is, that causes Suzanne, I think her name is, to be arrested in one of the prior episodes. There are Nazi soldiers roaming around town. He really doesn't understand any of it or what's going on. And he latches on to, and his mother's just died and his father's been in prison for 4 months. And he had the uncomfortable discovery along the way that he really doesn't mind spending more time with his uncle, who has a nice house and a more stable existence. And so he latches on to this big cuddly thing that his father finds, and he wants to protect it. And I think it's notionally a story about Captain Carrot, but it's really a story about Gustav and and how he is emotionally coping with the world around him.
You know, that's a great explanation, and I think quite true. All the more reason that I think his dad's behaving like a monster in this episode. But okay. Let's talk a little bit though about the action that gets kicked off around Sarah here, because not only did the kids getting arrested basically exonerate Sarah for the reason that she was fired, but she is still in jail. And is actually being questioned by the worst human being to ever live, Heinrich, who whenever he lights a cigarette, it is deeply scary. You now watch the show just like as he smokes with kind of a fear, because you never know when he's going to burn somebody with it versus offer them a cigarette. But I think
he does in his interrogation.
And he does with her.
Sarah, he offers her a cigarette, which he had done to a prior suspect whom he burns with the cigarette. And he just lets her take a whiff of it. And there's a lot of tension in that moment because you're afraid he's gonna scorch her with it.
Yeah, but one thing we've seen with Sarah is that she doesn't hold up great under questioning. We saw this before with Dick Cavern. No, with Marchetti. It was Marchetti who was questioning her. She kind of folded. She does this here again, gives up Lorraine, who is the person who abandoned them. No one feels that bad about that, though. I was kind of like, when Sarah did it and she didn't give up anybody else's name, didn't implicate Marie, just implicated the guy who abandoned them. Do you think that was, how did you judge her on giving up somebody in this? Did you think it was fair of her?
So this is advice for all listeners who, you know, may have occasion to be interrogated by a Nazi or an authoritarian or totalitarian secret police guy at some point in your future. When you give up information, you don't know what you're giving up because you don't know what else he knows. So she gives up only Laurent, which, you know, he abandoned and got a 7-year-old or 8-year-old child killed. He abandons a family that he's supposed to be helping, plus her, and they all get arrested. At least the lucky ones do. So she gives up only him, which is, as you say, not the worst thing in the world. The trouble is that Heinrich Müller, the SD guy, also knows that Laurent's wife, Marie, is somehow connected to Dick Cavern, whom he knows to be, or correctly believes to be, somehow involved in the espionage ring, or later learns to be. So the result is that while she gives up something that's individually not very important and actually morally kind of satisfying, it sets up a very dangerous situation in which there is now in the SD man's mind a clear and correct, as it turns out, link between Dick Cavern, the prostitute Natasha, Laurent, and Marie are all involved, and he has put this together in part on the basis of Sarah's quite innocent disclosure of the name of the guy who abandoned them. And, oh, by the way, he is quickly able to leverage that with the Jewish family and confirm it. And so he now has some pretty substantial information, even though the last thing you would feel bad for in the world right now is Laurent.
Yeah. So, and speaking of Marie and Dick Cavern, they are in this episode kind of hatching a plot You do finally get the prostitute's name, Natasha. If we've gotten it before, I hadn't caught it, but I definitely caught it in this episode, so I could stop calling her the prostitute in my notes. But what they're trying to do is, like, they set up this mission where she's gotta get Schwartz's passport, or the pass that he gets, not a passport, but a pass that he has that allows him to move between sides, because he's, you know, friends with von Ritter, Helmut von Ritter, the Germans, and he's working with them. And she needs to copy his signature so that I guess they can forge a pass. And she does this, protests a little bit, but she does it. And, you know, has sex with Schwartz, and they're still carrying on their affair, so that's normal. But she kind of leaves him upstairs, goes downstairs and tries to mimic his signature, and then takes it to Natasha, meets her in church. And then that allows Natasha to sort of go on this mission where she needs to find information. She's got to, like, break into a German office. Marie has to, like, decide here whether, because she basically goes from having a real love affair with Schwartz to one that is used to get information from him. How do you judge her actions on this?
Well, you know, you could say all's fair in love and war, and this is both, right? I mean, so she had opportunity to involve him in the ring and tell him what was going on and ask for his help. That is bad intelligence practice, right? I mean, in intelligence practice, you want to give as little information to as few people as humanly possible. And so, and partly, by the way, for their own protection. I mean, you know, if he knows stuff, he is in more danger than if he doesn't know stuff. So I actually don't fault her for thinking about it. You know, she's not a professional intelligence operative, but she's thinking about it like one. And she's saying, you know, if he knows something, we know he's cavorting with von Ritter. We know he has a real relationship with the occupation. If he knows stuff, he could reveal stuff, but either on purpose or by accident. It could also be tortured out of him. If he doesn't know stuff, he can't. So if I slip stuff out of his pocket and copy it, well, that's better for everybody. It's better for the operational security of the operation. It's also better for him. And I think it's not better for exactly one thing, which is trust between the two of them. And that breaks down as a result. And that's, you know, that is, by the way, in espionage, this is a problem among operational people to this day. One of the biggest, if you look at, you know, the operations directorate at the CIA, they have high divorce rates, high rates of, you know, people sort of what, as one of them described it to me, you know, you get a bunch of intelligence officers, eventually they start, you know, practicing tradecraft in their personal lives. And that is exactly what you see here. It is a trust eroding way to live. And, you know, Marie is doing an extremely fine job at what de Caverne asked her to do, but it's not a good way to build trust with your lover.
Right, which is already built on a lie and an affair. So I guess I don't see, like, I look at Marie, and I've said Marie's my favorite character. She is, and it is in these moments that I like her the absolute most. You know, Schwartz hits her, but and she kind of, you know, she is obviously concerned that she has broken trust. She knows what she's doing. But, like, the steely resolve that she has to participate in what is to her a pretty opaque way of helping. She doesn't even really know how the information she's gathering is being used, how it really helps. She just knows she wants to help. She wants to do something. She wants to be part of pushing back. And when you contrast that with Janine's day drinking, where her son comes home for lunch, which she's told him to do, and she's drunk at her desk, and, you know, you've got you've got Hortense, who is just sort of, you know, not teasing's not is too small a word, but is baiting and sort of torturing her husband, Dr. Larche, with letters from Marchetti, who misses her and, you know, is telling confessing his love to her. Like, they're just acting like children and spoiled and like they don't know what's going on. And Marie is putting literally every relationship that she has, she is putting this attempt to help the bigger sort of effort above. And it is one of the reasons I admire her and think that she's a really well-crafted character, because they do make it clear that she's willing to pay sort of the emotional price across the board with her husband and with her lover in service to doing something.
Yeah, she is one of the most admirable characters in the show. I do think, by the way, over these two episodes, De Caverne keeps growing on you as a character. He, you know, he starts out as a kind of greasy policeman type, but he is really, along with her, taking control of the situation, protecting his people on a pretty consistent basis. He takes extreme risks to himself for Natasha, which doesn't end up protecting Natasha, but that's through no fault of his. And he also makes pretty consistently good judgments about, you know, what needs to be done at different times. But look, Marie is, you find out in one of these episodes that she's barely been to school. She's went to school through until she was 14. She's uneducated. She's, you know, presumably not well versed in the political disputes that, you know, we have talked about that are separating different camps in France from one another. And yet all of her instincts are on the, you know, her basic moral instincts, at least politically, are all on the side that we would say is unambiguously and clearly right. She doesn't, and her sense of horror at her husband's behavior is our own sense of horror. She does stand for us in some very meaningful way, in a way that is not true of, you know, Marcel can only stand for you if you're sympathetic to the party in that period. You know, the cops, except for De Caverne, you know, the even Larche is a, you know, at the end of the day, he's a kind of admirable functionary of Vichy, but he is a functionary of Vichy. And, you know, she is somebody who is, you know, thinking in real time in a fashion that's roughly consistent with the way history regards morality in that period. And that's a pretty neat thing to see portrayed in a kind of unsentimental, unglorifying sort of way.
Yes. It's a great explanation. Okay, so right at the end of episode 11, the penultimate episode, the bunny is saved, but Schwartz is in trouble because Lorraine has shown up with a shotgun just as Schwartz and Marie are having the fight, where he has realized, because he's been hauled in by Heinrich. Heinrich notices a little blood stain on the pass, and Heinrich is putting together the fact that they have used Schwartz's pass, or somebody has used Schwartz's pass, to go gather this intelligence. And he asks Schwartz about the blood stain, and Schwartz makes up a lie, but he clearly knows that it was when she cut her finger. He saw her cut her finger when they were meeting, the day that she figured, you know, she copied his handwriting. And so they are in the process of breaking up, having a fight, him feeling betrayed, her being sorry, but obviously, you know, still having felt that it was worth doing. And Lorraine shows up just then and basically forces Schwartz to his knees, puts the gun to his head, and they give you the boom boom music. And so just when our relief for Captain Carrot, now we're worried about Schwartz and Marie, who, you know, being held at gunpoint. So we get into the finale, and Lorraine decides to take Schwartz into the barn where they kind of do a throwback to the day that they all three butchered the pig together. And he hoists Schwartz up on the, I don't even know what they're called, but gets him by his hind legs and hoists him up like a pig.
In order to, you know, cut his throat and drain his blood.
That's right.
Yeah, so this is where this lurking psycho quality of Laurent, which we've all kind of expected at some level. He's come back from the war a pretty damaged person, and that's clear from the time he gets out of the car and hugs Marie. There's something off about him. If he was a normal human being before the war, there's something, he's not quite right now. And that has been lurking in a sort of subcutaneous fashion since he reappears in the story. But it doesn't come out, right? There's something, yeah, he's trading on the black market. He's not, you know, Marie is keeping her distance from him. But you don't really see it as, okay, the full-blown, this is a really bad guy. He abandons the family, of course, but he doesn't kill the family himself, right? But here he is getting ready to torture Schwartz to death. And he does the torturing part. He also, you know, strikes his wife with the butt of a gun, which is, you know, that is no small, the butt of a shotgun is a significant piece of wood. And, you know, she is not seriously injured, but she certainly could have been.
She's kind of out cold at the end of the episode. And then she's come to, and he's got Schwartz in the barn. He's still holding her at gunpoint.
Yeah, there's some serious domestic violence going on there, yeah, which is not, you know, not focused on. It's kind of an afterthought because he's actually getting ready to kill somebody who's not, you know, who's not Marie. But he's brutally violent in these scenes. And he's also, you know, you can't talk to him. Marie tries to talk to him and Schwartz tries to talk to him, and he's frickin' crazy. And so I do think he shows, you know, it gets revealed who he is. And of course, by the end of the 12th episode, Marie is, you know, shoots him herself. And, you know, that's so I think the sort of trajectory of that story kind of comes to an end, that this is at the end of the day, a rabid dog, and he has to, you know, has to be put down. And of course he, you know, kills Natasha as well. And so I do think the sort of who is Laurent story is brought to a sort of not wholly unexpected end, but a very sort of dramatic and upsetting end at the end of this season.
Yeah, and of course, so there's the interesting thing about the way that Laurent dies and his vibrating with anger and insanity, the way that it all plays out is like they have this discussion, right? Like Natasha and Marie and Dick Verne are all thinking about how they're going to get out of here. And like, Dick Averne's like, you got to kill the guy. Like, we got to get rid of this guy. And Natasha is like, I can't be part of this. I can't do it. You know, this is another person. We haven't discussed her as much, but who is also to no benefit to herself, has just decided she's going to help, has sort of put herself in this danger, in this world. And, you know, you at no point see an incentive for either Marie or Natasha, or Dick Averne, for that matter, right? Why are the people who are doing right doing right? What is it that's driving them? And these three people who all are in the bedroom together discussing this sort of moral choice about whether you leave no witnesses, or whether, you know, you don't sort of succumb to murdering somebody, which is Natasha's position. It's just sort of interesting to me as you think about them, like, why are they the good guys? Why are they making these decisions? Why are they putting themselves in this mortal danger? For what? And it is just that sense of, I believe in a right. I believe in something right. I believe that what's happening here is unjust and wrong, and I want to be part of fighting it. And I find that amazing. I also will say this is another thing I love about Marie. There's this part where, you know, Dick Averne is like, clearly he's going to shoot Lorraine. He wants to shoot Lorraine. We know Natasha doesn't want it to happen. But when Lorraine comes in, he shoots Natasha, which changes the voting structure. And now you've just got Marie and Dick Averne, and Marie takes the gun and does it herself. And, you know, it could be read like, well, Marie in particular wants revenge in some way on Lorraine, but that's not what it is, right? What it is she's willing to have his blood on her hands. She's willing to take the responsibility and the emotional freight for his life, and believes that it is, again, in service to the greater cause. Like, she's being practical about what Dick Averne, the case he's making, which is you cannot leave this guy behind as a witness.
Yeah, and I also think she is, so there are so many, this is a short scene that is packed with so much interesting stuff. She is also, until the moment where he kills Natasha, she is looking for a solution. And at that moment, she realizes, and of course the solutions they're discussing are two, or basically three. One is there a way for Natasha to go into hiding in France, in Nice in particular, with her sister? Could they make it to the Italian zone? Now, this was an interesting historical point. Right at the end of the Battle of France, you know, the Germans blitz over France in a very sort of 3-week period. Right at the end of this, Mussolini declares war on France as well and sends troops north into, you know, collapsing France. And the result of this is that there is in southern France, a thin area that Mussolini got as an Italian occupation zone in France. And so the reference here is, you know, could you get down out of the German zone or out of Vichy control and into the Italian zone where things are a little bit more relaxed? And then the third option they're talking about is, could they get to Switzerland? So Switzerland is, according to them, 80 kilometers away. The border is relatively porous. And of course, Switzerland was then, as always, neutral. And it was not a safe haven for that many people, because the Swiss were pretty good at not letting a whole lot of people in. But a bunch of people did spend the war years in Switzerland. And of course, a lot of money spent the war years in Switzerland as well. And so she's looking for options here. You know, where can Laurent go? Where can she go where they're not going to be caught? Because Laurent will be tortured and will give them up if he's tortured, if caught. But then, you know, he does not play ball with this, and he tries to kill them and inadvertently kills Natasha instead. And at that point, she's like, all right, you know, and this sort of tradecraft side of her takes over, and she's like, I'm stop looking for a solution for you. You know, De Caverne is right. And, you know, she, I think your point that she's looking to, you know, she's willing to have the dirty hands herself, not just let De Caverne do it, but it's a kind of, right, I'm all in at this point. And she does it herself.
Yeah. It's a great scene. And then they run through, we know from a previous episode, there's a tunnel in this house. Schwartz has told her. And so they presumably escape through the tunnel. But it's funny, with all that action, the gunshots and the torture and all the dynamics going on there, to me, that is not the most interesting storyline in this episode. The most interesting storyline to me is where it kicks off with Dr. Larcher coming to his office, and there's a sort of gaggle of women, angry women there who are, you know, saying, hey, Mayor, we don't have any food. Like, there's no butter, there's no milk, our children are starving. And Larcher does this thing that I think is essential to who he is in this show, where he says, they ask him, have you gone without meat? Have you gone without bread? And he says, well, no, I make more than you. I'm a doctor. I made more than you before the war. And that's just the way class works, is basically his answer to their faces, right? Because this is the way that Larcher is like, well, there are self-evident truths. And I'm not necessarily thinking super hard about the morality of them. And he just says that. And then, of course, over the episode, one of the women, who is the one of the more aggressive women in the group, comes to Dr. Larcher with her son, who is starving to death. He's suffering from malnutrition. And Dr. Larcher is forced to confront it as the doctor, the humanitarian, not sort of the mayor, who now, you know, basically says to the help in his house, go get this kid some bread, some meat. And he kind of says to the mom, like, well, he needs food. He's, you know, whatever. And she's like, yeah, there's no food. Like, this is what's going on here. And so when he sees it as a doctor, he does, of course, the decent humanitarian thing in the moment, which is he finds food for the kid and then he's to bring him back. And ultimately, when she does bring him back to check on his digestion, you know, Larcher gives him 3 months of ration coupons and says, do not tell anybody that I did this, because he can't do it for everybody.
Although his wife sees it somehow. And that is sort of a foreshadowing of future tensions between them.
That's right. But it is interesting how the most interesting part of this episode is his evolution over the course of it. Right. And then so he goes to the deputy prefect to say, here's my plan. Here's my plan for how we're going to get food to all of these people who are out there starving. And the deputy prefect looks at the plan and says, wait, you're going to tax the wealthy to feed the poor? And he says, yes, exactly. And the deputy prefect says, have you been hanging out with your brother a lot? Like, he immediately views this idea as communist inspired. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I think there's a lot going on in this scene, right? It's in this sequence of scenes. It's Larcher, the humanitarian, and the communitarian versus the sort of class privileged person. But there's also an element here of vindictiveness with respect to his wife. So, you know, he knows that she's had an affair with Marchetti. He's basically arranged for Marchetti to be transferred. She is very bitter about it and reads him this letter and tells him, I'm in love with him the way I've never been in love with you. She is super unrepentant and mean about it. And how does he respond? He responds by becoming sympathetic with the attack on her privilege, right? She is quite well fed and getting whatever she needs by sending servants to buy things on the black market. And what does he do? He proposes, first of all, gives away her ration coupons to, you know, basically a random person with a malnutritious son,
He's suffering from malnutrition.
Suffering from a malnourished son.
Yeah.
Right. And then he also proposes a policy of systematically depriving people like her of the ability to take a disproportionate share of the resources. And so I think there's an interesting personal dimension of the politics. And so when he gets asked, have you been hanging out with your brother? His response emotionally, he doesn't say this, of course, is no, I've been hanging out with my wife. And, you know, and I'm...
And with you, jerk.
Right. Yeah. I've been seeing these fat and happy people who seem to think it's the natural order of things that they should be well-fed while other people are starving. And I just defended that the other day in the streets and then thought about it and had to examine a kid who was starving. And I was repulsed by it. And so I think he's always had this air of sort of extreme stoicism that annoys his wife. But he is increasingly prepared to, you know, engage in self-deprivation, particularly if he can drag her with him.
Yeah, that's funny. I do think it does seem unlikely to me that it has not quite occurred to him before that there are wealth disparities in ways that could be, I don't know, that could ping his conscience, prick his conscience. But still, forgetting that, the way in which he is thinking about this, and I think there is, for him, there's an element, right? It's because they're at war. The natural order previously was, of course, there are wealth disparities. Wealth disparities exist. The question is that what you got during the war is that now there were huge swaths of people who had nothing, like just weren't eating, and there was just not food getting in. And he was trying to figure out actively how to solve that. And the bureaucracy that was responding to it didn't want to solve it. Like, this is, to me, a real low point for the deputy prefect.
And there's competition in that sphere.
There is. But I have, you know, having seen the whole thing, and no spoilers, but I have sort of complicated, or I finished the show with some complicated feelings about the deputy prefect. But seeing his response here, which I'd completely forgotten about, I was like, oh yeah, man, you're the worst. So anyway, go ahead.
Right. So again, France is since the Napoleonic era, is a highly unitary state, right? This is not a federal system, right? And the mayor reports to the deputy prefect, reports to the prefect, reports to Vichy, right? There is this very, you know, these are not, there's nothing in France like the system where governors in the United States have independent sources of power. And this is a, you know, reflection of the fact that if you're a local mayor and you want to get anything done regarding feeding your people, you got to go through this, you know, this bureaucratic chain of command that is no joke and organized in this point of time with interests other than the humanitarian ones that may be pressing to you on the ground. And I think it's quite accurate that, you know, a food distribution system like this would not be something that a local mayor would necessarily be able to organize. And I also think that the sort of communitarian nature of this, of his proposal, would be looked at askance by that hierarchy at that time. And so, you know, I think it's a very interesting scene, and it's a and it's one that, again, does not, I don't think what Larchet is thinking about in this point in time is left politics. I think what Larchet is thinking about is sort of technocratic, how do you deliver services in the most efficient fashion to the most people in the face of the most urgent need. But he comes up with something that is, you know, in the socialist-y spectrum.
Yeah, it's the other thing that I would just say that I think this is reflecting is an increased scarcity, right? So we have seen through the show, as the time was on, right, there was this that the like, I can't remember if it was Easter, but they held some kind of supper soup, you know, a food thing for people who were poor, where they could come and they were kind of feeding people. But now it looks like lots of people who had been previously able to feed themselves no longer can. There's no longer access to food, and things are getting worse.
And you see that in episode 11, too, where, you know, Marcel faces, to go back to the Captain Carrot episode, you know, they're living off the land at this point. He's when he catches a rabbit, it is not for purposes of his son having a pet. And when he has three communist mucky mucks coming over for dinner, he's got a what the heck do I feed them problem. And so you do see food scarcity being a bigger and bigger issue.
Yeah. Hey, just since you brought it back up, one thing I wanted to ask you about the episode 11, so the communists come over for dinner and they have this weird conversation where, you know, one of them keeps saying, like, dialectics. And, you know, Marcel, who'd been chastised by kind of the big boss locally, who's now trying to suck up to whoever this next... The communists have their own bureaucracy that looks not that much different from the regular town's bureaucracy for all of their anti-establishmentarianists. But what was that conversation about? What was the point of it? What's happening there?
So this is a conversation about socialist communist tensions, which we've discussed earlier. The Communist Party and the Socialist Party, you know, are essentially one thing until the Russian Revolution, with different factions and World War One. They diverge radically from one another in World War One during the World War One period, and with the Soviet Revolution, the socialists become a parliamentary party in France, which they are to this day. You know, they occasionally even elect presidents of France. The communists are a revolutionary party controlled by Moscow and regard the socialists as a kind of gloss for the ruling regime. They are sometimes in coalition with one another, particularly, as we discussed in a previous episode, during the so-called during the period shortly before the war, where the left kind of united to put a government in place in France. This was the government of Léon Blum. But they hate each other. And so when Marcel teams up with the socialist Suzanne to distribute the November 11th flyers, he is doing so directly opposite party orders, which say, you know, you can't work with that traitor socialist. But then, of course, and as we talked about in a previous episode, this is the period of time in which the Soviet Union is, you know, essentially allied with the Nazis, right? They've divided up Poland. There's the Hitler-Stalin Pact. And so the Communist Party has gone from being ferociously anti-Nazi and anti you know, to being having this we're sitting this war out kind of attitude. They're not, you know, the Soviets are not anti-German, and so the Communist Party is kind of not engaged early in resistance. This changes decisively in the summer of 41 when Hitler stabs Stalin in the back and invades the Soviet Union. At that point, the communists become a very important part of the resistance. But in this period of time, they have this ambivalent relationship and they don't want to cooperate with the socialists. So you're seeing the beginning of that change here where, you know, Marcel could be in real trouble for violating orders and doing something with the socialists. But now there's a little bit of a different message from Moscow, which is, hey, maybe a little bit of resistance wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. You know, a kind of united front approach, maybe cooperate with the socialists a little bit. That message is starting to get through. And so the Communist Party, which of course can never acknowledge error about anything by the nature of what it believes, basically the instructions in this meeting are, you erred by doing the right thing too early. And so his immediate boss, you know, is like, hey, you defied party orders, right? You worked with a traitor socialist. But his boss's boss, who's a guest at the dinner, is like, no, he anticipated the party's position a few weeks before the party got it right. That's cool. Now, it's very funny. It's also deadly because in the Stalin era, you know, either one of those can get you killed. Now, less so in France, of course, than in the Soviet Union. But defying the party, being right too early can get you killed or can get metal pinned on you. And, you know, being a few days ahead of Stalin, you don't really want to do that. But also, you know, carrying the line too hard, once the line shifts, you can be associated with the prior position and get killed for that. So it's a real, but in this case, of course, the party doesn't have the power of life and death over you because they're not in charge. So you see it play out, not as you and your family get sent to a labor camp or get a bullet in your neck, but you and you, there's a debate over whether to praise you or condemn you, and it's all played out in comedy. But I think, you know, people who sort of know the history of Stalinism and this period of the party's existence, it has this air of menace to it because these are exactly the sort of things that are getting people killed all through the 30s and later in the 40s, less so during the war. In the Soviet Union.
Yep. Well, here, I just have one more plot point I want to wrap up.
And yeah, then I want to raise with you, too.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm just going to, as like a last plot point. So when, you know, Schwartz, Dick Averne shows up, shoots Lorraine in the hand, gets Schwartz down. Schwartz goes home to Janine and does this whole, like, I'm back for good. I broke things off with Marie. Obviously, isn't telling her the real story about Marie betraying him. And Janine acts all grateful about it. And I really, I find these things extremely annoying because I just really think, like, why are you kick this guy out? Like, what are you doing? But not that I've got any love for Janine. But still, I just found his whole, aren't you so glad that I've been cheating on you this whole time and now I've come back? Like, okay.
Well, the show does, let's be frank, take a kind of very French attitude toward marital fidelity, which is it's very optional in all circumstances.
Okay, but what's your what? But so I'm very. Do you have a bone to pick with me? You have a thing I think
I'm wrong about.
Oh, okay,
I do think, you know, there have been a couple of episodes where Schwartz has sort of risen in our estimation. He's been sort of admirable over the last few episodes. And here, I think, is where we see the limits of that. He's He's, you know, he begs for his life from Laurent. He does not seem capable of understanding that Marie is doing something for a larger reason that is actually admirable. And he, at the end, comes crawling back to his wife, grateful to be alive and to have a precisely the kind of middle-class lifestyle, bourgeois lifestyle, that Larcher is at the same time and with an equally repulsive spouse, you know, actually starting to resist a little bit and think about the justice of. And Schwartz is kind of, you know, happy to be back and away from these, you know, these people who can put you in danger by thinking about doing the right thing. And I think it's a kind of a lowish moment for him after several episodes where he's, you know, kind of begun to grow on you a little bit.
It's almost like he's much better when he's with Marie than with Janine.
You
not that it's
say.
Their responsibility, because he should be good or, you know, on his own merits, but
I mean, I think he's honestly, he's at his best when he's thinking about Sarah.
Yeah.
You know, he's this is a guy who is capable of real personal loyalty to people underneath him in the totem pole, who's willing to take risks. And he does, at the end of the 12th episode, get Sarah free. We say goodbye to to von Ritter, who has been transferred, lost his battle with the SD, which, by the way, is a harbinger of bad things to come, because the career German military are the sane ones here. They're the rational actors, and they're the people you can kind of do business with, whereas the SD people are the Nazi psychos. And so he's been transferred away. He comes to Schwartz's to say goodbye. And the last thing he does in office is release the Jewish former maid of Sarah Myers, which was something that the good side of Schwartz wants to see done and pushes for. And I think there's a really interesting portrait of the more and less attractive sides and more and less honorable sides of Schwartz in these last couple episodes.
Yeah.
So I have an issue I want to raise with you before we close, which is related to a point that you made earlier. You said that you watch this and there are just these people who do and don't decide to do the right thing, and it's never quite explained, and it's not necessarily the people you would predict. And you're talking about the show here, but of course, I don't believe you're thinking about the show when you say that. I think there's a lot of contemporary thinking when you say that. And I just want to hear you reflect on that, since the reason that we're doing this show has as much to do with contemporary matters as it does with, you know, the plight of the fictional village of Villeneuve in 1941. What does that say to you?
Right. So when I talk about the show, I've always said sort of it's a meditation on complicity, but it is also just a question about people. So why do people do the things that they do? What drives? And you're right. This is one of the things I found. One of the reasons I found it deeply interesting is that I've just, as we all have gone through like a 4-year period where we operate in a world of political actors, pundits, writers, think tankers, and actual politicians, and all manner of activists, right? They're all kind of here in DC, and people have their teams and their ideological attachments. But when presented with something that I would view as sort of objectively, where you could make an objective choice about what is right and what is wrong, a whole bunch of people whose opinions that I trusted, who I had been reading or who had I had respected or who I had worked with, chose wrong. Like in a way that I thought was, you know, and look, in the world that I move in of kind of never Trumpers, right? We all talk about this like invasion of the body snatchers. Like it was like watching people go crazy.
The great Ionesco play Rhinoceros is about this, you know, people you thought were normal suddenly turn into rhinoceroses.
I'm not familiar with that work, but
you should read it. It is literally a play that the absurdist playwright Eugene Ionesco wrote about fascist propaganda, that you had all these normal people who would say, you know, you thought believed the things that you say, and all of a sudden they have a rhinoceros head.
Yeah, well, in this case, I mean, it's the people who had written books about morality, you know, it just Bill Bennett, and, you know, talk about virtue and, you know, who had led the charge on character counting. And in the Trump era, you watched a lot of people and you basically you stood with, then there's a bunch of other people, right? There's this other group of people who had plenty to lose. And were sort of cast out of their old professional circles. You know, they lost the magazines that they ran, you know, whatever it was, they left their jobs. They were accused of all kinds of things, but they did it. Why did they do it? And like, if you, I've having been immersed in it, I've asked lots and lots of people on both sides of this. Why did you go along with it? Why, what's your, you know, I've listened to people rationalize going along with the Trump stuff. And I think I deeply understand the people who decided not to go along with it. And it really comes down to like a character question. Like it just is. It's a question of people who, in order to get to the outcome that they wanted for themselves personally, they contorted and rationalized. And, you know, when it came to ethics, it became all situational and it became all about, well, this other side is worse. People who had preached objective truth for as long as I've known them lost any sense of objectivity, and it became all subjective and about what somebody else could potentially do. And that's why I have to do this thing that I'm doing. And then there was this much smaller group of people who sort of, regardless of the consequences, just could not help themselves. They couldn't help that made them very annoying to the people who were figuring out how to accommodate things, where there was a group of people who just said, this is wrong, and I'm going to keep saying it's wrong. I'm just going to keep saying it's wrong, no matter what.
But here's, I think, one additional element that I think the show gets exactly right, and that gels really precisely with the point you're making about contemporary times, which is it's totally unpredictable who is going to be in that latter group and who is not. That, you know, if you look at this group of characters and you said at the beginning of the show, would it be the farm girl, the grizzled old police chief, and the prostitute who are being pursued by the SD guy at the end and are holed up in the farmhouse and are really the moral voice of the show at the end of season one, you would not have predicted that. And if you had said, would it be the Sarah Longwells and the Bill Crystals and the Tim Millers who are the sort of moral voice of the Republican Party, and I can say that because you can't, I don't know that I would have predicted that either. And more importantly, I certainly would not have predicted that people that I've co-written with and believed had values similar to mine would be the, you know, the deputy prefects, and also let's be honest, the Luciennes, the sort of, you know, letting the world act on you and dating the German soldier for reasons I can kind of understand because, like, life is hard. But at the end of the day, that's really, really not best practices. And our ability to predict who's going to be which is basically nil.
Yep. I think that's right. You know, speaking of Lucienne, she doesn't really appear in the last...
Yeah, we have a break from Lucienne.
Yeah, which I got to tell you, it's one of the things about the show, just as we kind of wrap up here after a full season, that it's always sort of just struck me as funny is like the show just kind of disappears people for periods of time, not just the main characters, but really the... So like... At some point, somebody mentions, I can't remember when it happens, but somebody mentions the soldier that the guy who had found that soldier in the tree and had dragged Marie and Dr. Larche out to help him and like who had probably stolen the ham and who played a bunch like a very central role
and
in
he's
creating.
Just gone.
He's just gone. Like nobody ever hears from him again. I'm not going to. I mean, maybe he comes back later. We don't know. But I'm just saying, at least for this season, it's this random guy who we are expected to think a lot about for several episodes is just gone. I will say it strikes me as bananas that Laurent and Marie, like he comes back from the war. He's not dead. He never sees his kids. Like the kids are still living with the in-laws and there's like no attempt. I mean, maybe they've seen them, but as best I can tell, mom shot dad in the head before the kids ever got to see him come home from the war. You know, I don't know where Tequiero went.
He's been missing the past couple episodes.
Like Hortense has all kinds of time on her hands. They don't have a maid right now. So like I can't be here to police every plot point, but I do find the show comical sometimes in like ways that it just takes threads that were very important and like lets them drop.
Well, speaking of which, this should not go unobserved before we close today, that this is the end of season one of the French Village podcast.
Yeah. 7 seasons to go.
Because we are plowing into season two. And I think we should call it season two on the podcast because it would be cool to have seasons of the French Village podcast.
Sure. And you know what? We're in charge. Great.
Next week. Join us for season two of the French Village podcast.
A French Village podcast.
Le podcast to you.
All right. See you guys. Have a great weekend.
Edith, take us out.
Nous nous aimions bien tendrement. Comme s'aiment tous les amants. Et puis un jour.